I was getting into big trouble, you know, around when I was 24, 25, and a few things happened, you know, that it was getting touch and go, you know what I mean? If I stuck around doing what I was doing, you know, I was probably going to end up dead.
Welcome to Green Rebel. I'm Emily O'Callaghan, and over the course of this podcast series, along with my co-host, Irina Jambazova, we will be speaking to some true mavericks of the creative industries. The name Green Rebel originated from what, for us, sums up a person who carves a unique path from their passion, and through hard work and persistence, makes that passion their career. This podcast aims to gather knowledge, inspiration, and a touch of advice from those who have done exactly this. The conversations with our guest will also naturally touch on subjects like Ireland's political and cultural past, present, and future. We would love to hear from you with your feedback about the show, or if you would like to be a guest or a sponsor. You can email us at greenrebelpodcast@gmail.com. Having Frankie Gaffney, author and activist, in for an interview was something I've wanted to do for a really long time, and he did not disappoint. The only problem was that we could have spoken with him for a much longer time and about a range of other subjects. In this short interview, he still manages to cover everything from Shakespeare through Joyce, via Marxism, Maya Angelou, Roald Dahl, politics, discrimination, racism, misogyny, Irish Twitter, and accidentally emailing filthy sex scenes from his book Dublin 7 to his mother. A Freudian click, if ever there was one.
We need to focus on real equality for everybody, every dimension. Every dimension of you know, every colour, every shade, every gender. And I don't think the current attitude or the current approach is trying to do that. I don't think it's even trying to do that.
He speaks passionately on subjects close to his heart, such as dialects, reading books, creating art, class equality, and the curse of social media. He also makes strong and convincing points with respect to equality for everyone. It was an honour and a pleasure for us to chat with Frankie, and we hope you enjoyed this interview as much as we did. Remember to share and download our podcast, and if you would like to sponsor the show, send us an email to greenrebelpodcast@gmail.com for more info. Also, make sure you rate and review Green Rebel on iTunes, Stitcher, or Overcast to be in with a chance to win prizes and invites to our drinks evenings. Thanks again for listening. Welcome to Green Rebel. Tonight we have our guest, Frankie Gaffney. Frankie is an accomplished author, he's also a political commentator and a somewhat reluctant journalist. Welcome to the show, Frankie.
Thanks, Millie, for having me.
So you and I have known each other for about 17 years.
Yeah. It's funny, I kind of forgot about that when you asked me to come in. And having done podcasts and radio and television, you know, because you're an intellectual and you're interested in that world and a comedian and stuff like that, I kind of forgot that we know each other from before any of us were in any way involved in these affairs.
Sure. And so at the moment you're working on your PhD, is that right?
It was due on the 1st of September, and we're in late November now, so it's overdue, but I've a bit of an extension. They've granted me some time. I had a lot going on the past few years, so it'll be done.
What's the subject?
I'm in the English department, so I'm looking at literature, but it's from a linguistic perspective. So the title of the PhD is Looking at the Novel. So I'm interested in the appearance of text, you know, so the layout, fonts, you know, punctuation, spelling as well. People kind of forget that spelling, you know, people think that words are composed of letters, but writing was a late invention. We had language for hundreds of thousands of years before, or not hundreds of thousands, but, you know, tens of thousands of years before we had writing. And spelling was just, you know, spelling, even in terms of the history of writing, spelling is a late alphabetical spelling is a late invention as well. Prior to that, there was the hieroglyphics and then syllabaries and different kinds of ways of writing down words that you had to remember. You know, different, you know, hundreds and hundreds of different symbols. You know, so the Chinese system has 1,000 symbols or something like that. And alphabetical spelling allowed you to break it down into kind of into sounds. But it's not a natural. Children have to learn that by rote. They have to be taught it. It's not an intrinsic part of language or anything like that. So I'm looking at spelling as well, and particularly dialect spelling. You know what I mean? So I was massively influenced by Roddy Doyle, and he kind of spelled Dublin English the way I spoke. Fucking, you know, he'd leave out the G on the end of fucking, because we say fucking, not fucking. And things like that. So I'm kind of interested in that kind of non-standard spelling. And loads of that stuff. I could talk. See, this is the thing. People always regret kind of asking me that because I go on some rant about. I spent a year writing about ellipsis points. You know, dot dot dot. So it's fairly esoteric interest. It's not of general relevance, but it gets me going. The lads give me funny looks when I start talking about it after a few points.
Where did the interest come from? Where did it start from?
I suppose when I did my undergraduate degree in English, I kind of reflected at one point, because I was interested in the dialect spelling, because it was the way I spoke, and you know, I didn't speak this standard kind of dialect. And then I reflected on everything we talked about for the whole course of the 4 years, all the books we'd looked at, talking about the plot, the characters, the structure, you know, talking about Marxist theory, feminist theory, post-colonial theory, all of this kind of stuff. But we could have been talking about audio versions of the books, and they're not. An audio version is quite different. You know, you engage with a novel with your eyes, not your ears. And we didn't talk about how the books looked. We talked about them as if they're these abstracted streams of language that exist in some kind of platonic sphere out there. You know, as opposed to the reality that they're objects that you buy and look at. So, looking at the novel. That's the research.
And did your mother ever mention that you were very interested in books and literature when you were a young child, or language?
She really, really encouraged me. And, I suppose I haven't been messed up in a lot of stuff that I shouldn't have been when I was younger. You know, people often congratulate me for escaping it and going to university, writing a book and all this kind of stuff. But I say, look, the lads that I know that are in prison or that got shot or, you know, that didn't escape or that are, you know, strung out on gear or... they didn't have that option because their mothers didn't encourage them in the way that mine did. Look, I found a notebook there, you know, recently I was moving house the last time I moved, and it was little dots of letters, you know, that she had marked out for me to join up when I was a little tiny kid. So, then I just got my own passion for it. I suppose it was good for her in the end, because once you start reading, once a kid start reading, if you give them a book, they'll fuck off into a little corner and just occupy themselves. And I was her only kid, so it was just the two of us. So it was probably a bit of a reprieve for her then.
Free
but kind of. But she's a massive reader. Like she used to read, you know, she'd slaughter books. Like she'd go in and get, you know, 6 books at a week at the library and she'd read them, you know, and she'd sit down. I remember her just sitting down and reading, and me and the cat trying to get her attention and failing, you know what I mean? And
what were the books you were reading? What are books you remember from that time?
When I was a little kid, you know, as soon as I discovered Roald Dahl, that was it. You know, and I still think he's a master. I don't know, did you read Roald Dahl in translation or did you read it in English?
I would have read it in translation.
Yeah.
I remember when Matilda came out, and then some of the other books. I loved them, and they were written in such a... they were very well translated, and it made a...
Yeah, because I was going to say that, because he's so peculiar, you know, the language that he uses and you know, even the names and stuff like that. I suppose they just probably used the names directly, did they?
Yeah,
it's funny, but yeah, he was, you know, huge. Then I was a little bit older, probably The Chronicles of Narnia. And then, look, I would have started reading adult books then, the simpler adult books, like the Roddy Doyle ones, I just fucking devoured and just read them over and over and over again. But it was like that as well. I wanted to reread constantly. I was resistant to reading new books. I'd have a collection of books and I'd, you know, go through them. I remember as well, there was a phase when I was about 10, I read The Colour Purple. You know The Colour Purple?
Yeah.
And Maya Angelou, I Know Where the Cage Board Sings, and these, you know, black women, kind of autobiographical, literary biographies, and I got mad into them for some reason as well when I was a kid. So yeah, I kind of read varied reading interests.
So as you were reading them, did you ever think that you one day may write books yourself?
When I was a little kid, I used to be really good at drawing, and I used to draw all the time, and I'd bring it up to my ma, and she'd give me kind of a review of my drawing, like an in-depth, you know, well, I like the shading on this, but his head is out of proportion, and, you know, this kind of feedback, and I just reveled in that. And I think it's the same thing then with the writing. So I thought I was going to be an artist. When I was a little kid, people say, what do you want to be in your group? I want to be an artist. Then when I was a little bit older, I want to be a film director. So I always wanted to, you know, to create stories, I suppose, you know what I mean? Or to create art. And then because I read so much, I felt, and then getting the opportunity to go to Trinity and having lived a kind of exciting life, you know, in comparison to some authors, some Irish authors in particular, I think there's a bit of homogeneity in Irish writing at the moment that I think needs to be shaken up. But I kind of felt then that I was in a good opportunity to write something. I kind of felt there was a duty to do it.
Your novel Dublin 7, when that first came out, even though your mum was familiar with books by Roddy Doyle and that kind of thing, and as you mentioned, the language were what's known as bad language, and Dublin 7, it has a good few swear words in it. Mm. Was she shocked by that, or did she understand that that's...
No, well, yeah, no, my ma, you know what I mean, she was a hippie, then a bit of a punk, you know what I mean, she had me when she was 17, and she was a rebel, you know what I mean, so she wasn't shocked by that, but I don't know if you know this story, do you know this, I thought you might be teeing me up for this anecdote. I wrote it down in a writer's retreat down in the Bear Peninsula in Cork, the name of the retreat is Annam Cara. And Sue Buford runs it. I'd recommend it to anybody who wants to write a book. Just 2 weeks down there, and I wrote most of it in those 2 weeks, you know. So I'd recommend that to anybody who wants to write. At the time, there was no Google Docs, so it was 2011. Or if there was Google Docs, I didn't fucking know about it. And so I used to email at the end of every session, you know, consistently emailed whatever piece I'd done to myself.
Yeah.
The book has 7 chapters, each one corresponds to one of Shakespeare's 7 ages of man. The tour chapter is the lover. That's where all the sex scenes start. And when I was emailing to myself, my ma has the second name, same second name as I do. So when I was typing it in, I clicked on her name by mistake and sent her this big, huge sex scene, like really, really explicit, without any explanation. Do you know what I mean? She knew I was down there writing, but I didn't say, this is a section of my new book, this is the tour chapter. I just sent her this big, huge, filthy sex scene. And I was like, oh my God, I can't believe I done that. And trying to ring her then, and there was no coverage to get her not to open it. Do you know what I mean?
And click?
That is the initial explanation that does, I'm sure, spring into mind. I don't know. I'd like to think it was just an accident and there was no kind of Jungian psychological trauma going on. But yes, anyway, she did open it. She did read it. She sent me an email back. Oh, that's brilliant. That's brilliant. So... it was traumatic experience, but I tell you, it was good because after that there was no embarrassment. So you know, it is like now I wouldn't give a fuck, you know what I mean, about what I'm writing. But I suppose writing sex scenes and stuff like that and putting them out there, you know, when you have hang-ups and things like that beforehand, you know, I got over that pretty quick. When your ma fucking has to read this and it's pretty graphic, you know what I mean, so it was probably a good thing all around.
So aside from a very explicit sex scene that your mom saw maybe a bit too early,
yeah.
What else happens in the book? Tell us a bit about what the book is about.
Love Hate, well, I hadn't seen at the time. I wrote it in 2011. Love Hate, I think, was out or just coming out. And you know, there'd been other kind of portrayals of the Dublin underworld in books and film. I really liked I Went Down. Do you remember that? With Brendan Gleeson, film. But that was a kind of stylized portrayal, you know what I mean? There'd never been, you know, I felt lack of authenticity in the portrayals, not just of the Dublin underworld, but of working class Dublin, let's say. So as well as that, you know, I'd known people who were killed and, you know, had been involved in crime and stuff like that. It wasn't the way it was. The papers were making out. You know what I mean? Like, I'm not saying it was for better or for worse or any more. You know, there's no kind of morals involved, but it was just a very false perception that the, you know, people have of that world and how things work. You know, so I wanted to write an authentic portrayal of it. And because I'd lived in that world, and then I'd gone to Trinity and got, you know, this, you know, great education in literature, I felt it was a good symbiosis. And as well as that, I suppose, like, you know, that phrase, "Non de Gardie," crops up in the book. I don't know if you know about that, but Emily, maybe you can explain that.
So if someone is mentioned on the news and there's been a crime committed, they will often say, the Gardaí say that this person is known to them. So,
or if someone gets killed, they'll say, "Known to Gardaí." Kind of like he's a cold war, or he's a gangster, you know what I mean? But they don't say.
We're familiar with him. We've met him several times.
So it's kind of a euphemism, you know, it's kind of a euphemism for saying, "Oh, this person's a gangster." And, you know, especially, you know, after people were killed and that kind of thing, I felt it was kind of something sinister in the way that they said it. Like, you know, it's just, oh, no, like if you heard about a murder, you'd be waiting for the victim was known to Gardaí, and then you go, "All right, fuck it. Well, forget about that. Doesn't matter."
You're not meant to be upset about it because they had it coming or something.
Yeah, it's a bad person, you know, don't feel bad.
Yes, yeah, exactly, precisely, yeah.
So your characters, were they, you know, based on people you knew, or how much was it fiction and how much was it non-fiction?
Yeah, I get this a lot, like, and it's surprising because I get it from fucking friends, you know what I mean, who say, "Oh, it was great, that bit when you went into the pub," and I'm like, it's not fucking about me, and I'm very, very different than the young fella in the book. A lot of people that didn't know me before I wrote the book conflate me with Shane, who was the main character. But, you know, I hadn't taken it. Like, he gets into drugs when he was 18. I didn't take drugs till I was 22. You know, very, very different. And I was into reading, you know, this kind of stuff. And he's kind of, you know, this typical young fella. There are a lot of characters and correspondences and dialogue and things like that I plucked from life. But, like, so characters, for example, I'd compound characters. So I'd take two people and blend them into one. And suddenly they become a new person and take on a life of their own. And they kind of start doing things. You know, it's kind of magical, you know, when you do that. They suddenly start saying things that neither of the two people that you were thinking of would say individually. But you create this new character and they take on a life of their own. I remember the most thrilling moment, you know. I went into the publishers after I got the deal signed, and I went in to do something to you know, it was before the book was published, but a girl that was working in the office had read the manuscript, and she asked me a question, you know, about Elizabeth and Shane. "Oh, did this happen?" Like, as if they were real people. And, you know, I was just like, boom, that's it. And I was just like, right, I've achieved what I wanted to achieve. Whatever about sales, whatever about anything, one person has entered into that fictional world and, you know, kind of engaged with it. So the important thing to me, though, was not that anything did happen in the book, but that it could. So, for example, one of my mates, his best mate is in the Joy in Mount Joy Prison, and they got the book. You know, the book is in the library there, and they're all reading it, and everyone's like, "Oh yeah, no, that's dead on. It's accurate. It's right." And that was, you know, a big thing for me, that there was no detail. So when we'd be watching Love Hate, and Love Hate was great in some ways, but we'd be watching Love Hate and going, "Oh, they wouldn't say that, you know what I mean? Her accent is wrong. You know, you'd have gloves on if you were doing that." You know, this kind of stuff. And there'd be some fucking detail, just one thing, like, you know, and it could be, everything else could be perfect. And then you'd just say Gardaí in a country accent or something, you know what I mean? Or, you know, some other thing that, you know, you wouldn't do or you wouldn't say, or, you know, his t-shirt would be fucking wrong. He'd wearing a t-shirt that, you know, young fellas wouldn't wear or something like that. And that would really just, boom, just ruin the whole thing, kind of, you know, that moment. So I don't think I don't think there's anything in my book anyone can pick me up on and say that couldn't happen. And that was, you know, the most important thing in terms of reality.
If you know it goes down well in the Joy, you know you're...
That's it. Yeah. That was the fucking... I want to put that review on the cover the next time. One of my dad's old mates said to me, you know, we were getting reviews in and this kind of stuff, and he commented on my Facebook and he'd read it, and he said, "More sex than 50 Shades of Grey and more violent than Ballyfermot in the 80s. And I asked the publisher to put that on the next cover, but they said, "Look, you can't put comments by some random male fella on the cover of your book, you know."
Well, after the book came out, you started to get sucked in or called on to comment on
Dublin and the world of the guards and criminals, or the grey area there. You got a lot of flack, you got a lot of criticism, which continues to this day. You're well able to take it, but how did that come about? Or tell us a little bit about how that transition happened. And because you were always probably outspoken, but...
just not one fucking listened to me before, but then, yeah. So some enterprising young rascal took it upon himself to do a mural from around where I'm from, you know, with a quote out of the book, and it's the Nantes Gardaí bit, and it says, Nantes Gardaí, that vile euphemism deserved it, in other words. And there was, you know, big kind of painting and all of that. And one of the editors from the journal, thejournal.ie, saw and got in touch with me and asked me to write an article about that phrase, which was a great idea. And I met her actually, and I hadn't met her before. I met her a couple of weeks ago in TV3. What was I? Where was I going? It was for the Pat Kenny show. And I was saying, you fucking started it all. You know what I mean? You started all the trouble I'm in now comes from you asking me to write that article, because one article led to another article to another article. And, you know, I kept on saying it. Every article I've written since then, I said, this is my last article. I'm not doing it anymore. And I've been, you know, really sincerely meant because of the PhD. I said, until after the PhD. And then something happens, or fucking something. I'm writing an article about that. That was how. That's how I got into it. I'd like to know how I'm going to get fucking out of it. But
when was the last article you wrote on the subject?
The last article I wrote was for the Village magazine, and it was back to the subject of the guards, and it was about... It was a contrast and the reaction among Irish kind of liberals. I won't name names, but very prominent commentators on equality issues and things like this. And, you know, it just bewilders me, this kind of the adoption of American political theory and things like this that aren't relevant here. It's not that they're not relevant here. They are relevant here, but not to the same extent. You know, and if you're talking about gender, you're talking about race, and you're talking about sexuality, and you're not talking about class in Ireland in 2017, there's something wrong there, you know. And listen to me, if someone's just talking about gender, I'm like, all right, that's cool. If someone's just talking about race, I'm like, grand. If they're just talking about sexuality, that's fine. But if you're talking about those three, and then you're not going to talk about class, well, why aren't you talking about it?
Do you think the taboo, or people are too sensitive over it?
I don't know, you know what I mean? It's something I ask myself, and I never really believed, like, I never, you know, I always give people the benefit of the doubt, you know, when it comes to classism especially. I would say, oh, because it's, how do you know, you know, how do you know if someone's kind of discriminating against you or looking down on you, you know what I mean? It's hard to tell. But, you know, as time goes on, I think they're fucking frauds, a lot of them, to be honest. I think, having seen them be challenged on it, like, I don't like to call people out, so I haven't engaged in that, but there's a few people that I'm tempted to just go, hold on a fucking minute here, you know what I mean? You know, on the one hand, you're talking about gender equality, and then you're fucking bigging up Kate O'Connell, you know, or, you know, Fine Gael TDs that are diametrically opposed to any kind of equality for the people of this country. So it's, yeah, I don't know. It's one of those. This is the thing. You're already getting me into trouble now. I start getting angry, and then I come across like this fucking angry wanker, you know.
Irina will tell you I'm the exact same when I get going. You know from my Facebook everything I get going on this.
Yeah,
but we can put in beeps over names and words if you want.
Yeah. No, I won't. Like, this is the thing. I'm hoping. So sometimes as well, I think, you know, it's not on the radar. And like I was talking to a fella today, and he was saying about a comedy panel show. And I hadn't seen it, and it's from a few years back, an Irish one. And he was saying, oh, there's some, you know, posh comedian, and he was saying knackers. And he was saying, I don't mean travellers, I mean Dublin scumbags. So it was kind of acceptable. And the thing is, I was saying to my mate, well, we used to say that, and we were the knackers, do you know what I mean? We were, and we used to say it about people that we felt were another rung down, do you know what I mean? So there is that kind of, you know, like, you know, it's constant, and it, you know, it's not seen as bad as racism or anything like that. But when you think about it, you know, again, like, you know, it's unacceptable now to refuse someone from a pub or a nightclub because they're black, as it should be. But every fucking night of the week in this city, you have young men in particular getting refused from nightclubs because they have an accent like mine. Every night of the week. Doormen are told not to let them in. You know, you have people changing their address when they apply for jobs, you know, using a fake address. You know, and the police, they wouldn't say the N-word to refer to a black person, but they'll say scumbag, they'll say knacker, they'll say scrout. So I think travellers are probably the most discriminated against group in the country. You know, in real terms, I think that's the most heinous and egregious and constant and traumatic, I suppose, form of prejudice. You know, how, like, 80% of Irish people said that they wouldn't want to live next door to a traveller, you know. And imagine that, like, if people were talking about black people, can you imagine, you know, in America or something, you know, 80% of...
It's discrimination.
It's on a fucking massive scale. But then, you know, with the class stuff, I think the class stuff, I don't think it's as extreme, you know, because, you know, you can't mix and things like that. But I think it's there under the surface, and I think there's a real hostility to talking about it. And I think because a lot of the people, most of the people in power, like, there was an article today in the Trinity News, and it's about gender equality, and great, and it was calling out or saying that the provost of Trinity, the head of Trinity College, has he picks, you know, 50 people to be on a council, and only 10 of them or 12 of them or something are women, you know, and that's not good enough. You know, if he's picking them, they should be half and half. But I can bet you none of them are working class, you know. So yeah, I think, you know, these people talking about gender, race, and sexuality in 2017 in Ireland, to me, it's a bit like going into the doctor and I have a massive growth on my testicles that's malignant, and the doctor starts talking about me ingrown toenail. Do you know what I mean? I think that's, you know, people say, oh, it's whataboutery, and, you know, they're talking about this, why are you bringing up something else? And I'm saying, okay, well, you need some proportionality and some perspective.
Yeah, if it's diversity, it needs to be full-on diversity.
That's it. Yeah, yeah. You can't have equality for equality has to be for fucking everybody, or it's for nobody. You know, yeah. That's the essence of it.
Going back to your story, and, you know, kind of you making that jump from kind of the things that you were involved when in Dublin 7, and then going off to Trinity and going into literature. What happened there? How did the jump happen?
I suppose when I got a bit older and I kind of lost the art and the drawing and all of that, you know, I was reading. It was in the back of my mind. And even by the time I was 20 or 21, you know, I'd already been through some fucking mad shit and thought, oh, you know, this would be great material for a book. And, you know, but I had the self-discipline of Blue Bottle Fly. Do you know what I mean? I, you know, had the attention span of a gnat. And, you know, I was out drinking, partying every weekend, and I couldn't escape the cycle of it. You know what I mean? I couldn't save any money. I couldn't, you know, if I had money, I just blew it on, you know, and yeah. So, you know, I started kind of thinking, oh, this will never happen. And then, you know, I was getting into big, big trouble, you know, around when I was 24, 25, and a few things happened. You know, that it was getting touch and go, you know what I mean? If I stuck around doing what I was doing, you know, I was probably going to end up dead. So I got a few wake-up calls, and it was, you know, the cops were kind of getting on top of me as well. And I said, right, I need to get out of this. I need to change my life. And I went back. I did a course on Ballyferma for a year, and I just, you know, took off. And I kind of was trying to manage to... You know, I've never given up drinking or whatever, but I was managing to say, okay, well, I'll hold off for a couple of weeks and I'll get that assignment done and then I'll go out after that. You know, that kind of way, rather than just be, you know, just a slave to my, you know, libido, you know, whatever, of whatever description. So, yeah, so then at that, I'd done very, very well because I was reading so much. You know, I realised that, you know, I thought everybody just read books every night. When you got into bed, you read a book. You know, I didn't realise that that's not what everybody did. So I kind of had an advantage, I suppose, over a lot of people, and then applied to Trinity. I didn't have my leaving cert, so I failed my leaving cert. But there was a get-out clause in Trinity then. You could apply as a mature student. So I applied to... I had to do 5 interviews and write a little essay and things like that. And, you know, it was really down. I just wanted to get into Trinity as well because Trinity had the most cachet. You know? And then, yeah, so I wanted to do the best, you know what I mean? And then when I was in Trinity, I wanted to get a first... And then, you know, so I got a first, and then, you know, I wanted to get a master's, got the master's, then was doing the master's, I wanted to, you know, get the PhD, but then, you know, I wanted to get the best, so I got the scholarship, you know, the fellowship, the Usher Fellowship's most prestigious fellowship there. So everything then, I was just, like, trying to do the best I could. And then when I was doing English, you know, I was like, right, I really, really want to write a novel, and I want to have it done by the time I'm 30. So I wrote it before I was 30, didn't get published until a good bit later. And there was, I kept editing after that, but I had it written before I was 30, you know.
It seems that you kept setting yourself goals and that worked for you. You've mentioned to me before as well about, like you just mentioned, the giving up drink for a while kind of really helps with actually getting your bum on the seat and getting it down.
Yeah, I think Irish people particularly, you don't, you know, again, like I've been kind of partying a lot again lately. And so I'm not a fucking Puritan, you know, telling people, you know what I mean? But, you know, I think I didn't realise the effect that it has on you. And if you give it up for a couple of weeks, you know, so you get over your hangover and you think, right, I feel back to normal. But if you give it up for a couple of weeks, you feel like Usain Bolt going around the fucking place. You know what I mean? Like fucking, you know, like you're the healthiest person in the world and you're bouncing around. And, you know, so, yeah, it really knocked me productivity through the roof and things like that, and just, yeah, you know, as well as that, you know, people who are drinking, if you notice people are drinking a lot, they're always catching up, I have to go, and you know, it's put off till the next day, and you know, they're not have this breathing space, you know what I mean? So, and I'm a bit like that at the moment. I'm thinking about myself, I'm thinking, right, I need to get my shit together. We stayed in this weekend though, so I'm feeling good, but I'm going in tomorrow.
We talked a bit about you know, this the distractions that we have, and you know, especially when it comes to books. And that used to be the telly, and now it's almost the telly is the distraction that we need to have from social media. And you talked a bit about this. Tell us about your relationship with social media.
Yeah, so because of, you know, I suppose having been a bit, what we say in Dublin, he was a bit of a bogey. Means he was a bit like, you know, not someone who obeyed the law all the time. I was kind of averse to social media, and we would have had, you know, kind of throwaway phones and this kind of thing when I was younger and stuff like this. And I never went on it. You know, I remember, you know, going out with a girl and she's on Facebook, I wasn't on it and things like this, and all our friends are like, why isn't he on Facebook? You know what I mean? This kind of stuff. And I never went on it. Even then, all the way through university, I never went on it. And I was just totally averse. I'm very, very private, you know. And then I kind of had to, I'd set up a Facebook page, you know, kind of badgered into it by an ex-girlfriend, and eventually set up a Facebook page. And then when the book was coming out, they said, right, you need to set up a Twitter, you need to set up an Instagram, all of this shit. And so I was like, okay. And did it reluctantly, and then because of an addictive personality, got fucking hopelessly addicted to all of it, and just saps loads of my attention. But I might as well work for fucking Facebook, just creating content for them for free every day and driving their advertising revenue. We should get a percentage off Zuckerberg. Maybe look into to that.
So is it more creating content, or is it dealing with comments and getting in different debates?
Got into a lot of rows, yeah. But you know, and that's the thing. People would say to me, "Oh, you love a good row. You love a good row." I fucking hate rows. I hate rows. But at the same time, I'll stand over what I say. I think the big learning experience for me was, you know, having to realise that loads and loads of people are not genuinely interested in having a discussion. They're not reasonable. And something that they believe, if they don't believe it, if it wasn't reasoned into their head, you're not going to reason it out of their head. So, you know, it's kind of recognizing that. I try to stay out with the spats now. But at the same time, if someone's slandering me, if someone's smearing me, I don't give that a free pass, because people say, oh, just ignore it. But no, fuck that shit. You know what I mean? You know, you just ignore it. You know, they'll say whatever they want about you. So I think there's some very, very bad people saying Irish Twitter and things like that, masquerading as people who care about serious issues, important issues that I care about. And they're using those issues to attack other people for personal aggrandizement. And people are afraid to criticize them over it, because they've consolidated themselves as a group, and they'll attack anyone. And I think it's a very, very sinister development. And I don't know how to tackle it, because on the one hand, I don't like call out culture. And on the other hand, how do you fight against these people? You know what I mean? How do you, you know, and, you know, I will, if someone is coming at me, if they're a repeat offender, I always give people a chance as well. Try and sort it out privately with them. You know what I mean? This is another thing that's been said about me. Oh, he DM'd me, you know, like, you know, as if that's some sinister thing. Well, look, you know, I'd say to someone, look, what's the issue here? You know what I mean? Let's sort it out. And that hasn't gone well either. Like, I have lost a rag with people on occasion, because they'll be like, someone will have said publicly that I said something I did not say, and I'll send them a message and go, Look, I didn't actually say that. I'm thinking, okay, maybe they're genuinely mistaken. And you just learn that they do not care. They don't care. They know that they're going to get, you know, 100 retweets or, you know, 100 likes off it. And they don't care whether you said it or not, you know. Yeah, so I don't know. I don't know how to fucking deal with it. I'm bad. Don't take my advice. Whoever anybody wants to deal with it, whatever I'm doing is not fucking working, that's for sure, you know.
Have you worried for your personal safety, or how bad is it?
No, and I know, like, you know, people talk about women getting much more abuse, and I think, you know, like, it is more sinister, you know, the threats. There seems to be, Angela Nagle's written about this in Kill All Normies, you know, some of the stuff that, you know, the this kind of repressed misogyny and hatred, vitriolic hatred for women. Seems to get a lot of expression, and you know, you don't get that kind of stuff, you know, that kind of, like, there were, I've been threatened and people said, you know what I mean, things to me, but you know, I wouldn't be scared of that. Like, I prefer that than someone, you know, consciously manipulating things to make it look like I've said something I didn't say, you know what I mean. I mean, today I have a professor talking about somebody giving really bad abuse to Tara Flynn. And she said, so she screenshotted this abuse that Tara Flynn got off some anonymous account. And then she screenshotted another thread from me about something else, you know what I mean, on a similar subject. And I was saying, and, you know, said, and other people followed suit as if I was part of this, you know what I mean? And I would much prefer to get in a physical fight with some fella than have to deal with that, because, you know, I can't, you know, what do you do? What do you do about that? This is, you know, some professor that's doing this, and you know, if you say anything or, you know, go mad at them, it's very easy to portray me as the aggressor.
Yeah.
And I think because I'm a fella, and you know, my accent and, you know, things like that, it's there's this kind of perception of me that I'm an aggressive, and I am. I am, but only when provoked, you know what I mean? Only when provoked. Like, that's the thing, like, you know, they've been giving out about me and saying, oh, he's fucking horrible to people and all this. I've never gone after anybody. They come to me, you know, they come to me, and it's only after provocation that I'll defend myself. So there was the L'Oreal thing where your woman said, all white people are racist. Now, if all white people are racist, none of us are racist. So that's bullshit for a start. You know, I think it's crazy shit to be saying. And when people said that's crazy stuff to be saying, Everyone said, if you disagree with saying all white people are racist, you are saying that systemic discrimination against black people doesn't exist. But that's not what you're saying, you know? So it's the same thing now, misandry. So all of these people are falling over themselves to say, there's no such thing as misandry. And if you say, no, there is, they say, no, there's no systemic discrimination against men. I say, no, that's not what we're saying. Look, I get my definition of words from the fucking dictionary, not from Tumblr. You know, and if you look up the dictionary, misandry is, you know, an ingrained kind of, you know, prejudice or dislike towards men. And, you know, look, if people are tweeting the hashtag men are trash and stuff like this, you know, that's misandry. And, you know, the excuse for that is, we're not talking about all men. It's obvious we're not talking about all men. But you would never accept that if someone was saying Muslims are trash. You wouldn't just go, oh, I didn't mean all Muslims. Oh, you're so stupid picking me up on that. You know what I mean? Like, you know, I didn't say all Muslims. You know, it's crazy. So you can't persist with these double standards. And, you know, it's really, you know, it's damaging these causes, these good causes. Gender equality is a fucking seriously good cause that I believe in. And people abusing it and, you know, saying these things that are just ridiculous, you know, I think is taking credibility away from these important issues. And also, if you look at the propaganda of the alt-right and things like this, it's scary. They are obsessed by the ideological contradictions of identity politics on the left. That is their main tool. Well, that and racial anxiety, you know what I mean? And you know, kind of stoking up. So, you know, kind of making out that Muslims are, you know, raping white women and things like this. These kind of, you know, very emotive subjects. But also then, if you look at their reasoned arguments, it's all about the ideological contradictions on the left. And those ideological contradictions don't need to exist. We don't need to say all white people are racist to fight fucking racism, you know? So why would you say it? It's just kind of taking a position to be ultra, you know, radical or whatever, you know, for no reason. So I think it's crazy. And also the obsession with language policing. I know people that say, that use racial epithets, you know? I know people that make racist jokes. I know people of many different races that do that, that are not racist. They aren't. right? And I know people that would never say a fucking racist word, that would never say it, that are racist to their bone or sexist to their bone, that would never say bitch, but they are ingrained sexist. And I know fellas that would, you know, make sexist jokes that aren't. So the focus on language policing rather than, you know, the structures and the, you know, like, we need jobs, we need healthcare, we need houses. Everybody needs these things. Black people, white people, men, women, you know, trans people, everybody. And you can't change the language. It's not going to give someone a house and give someone somewhere to live. And it's not going to give them healthcare or give them food. So I think we need to focus on real equality for everybody, every dimension of, you know, every color, every shade, every gender, every, you know, and I don't think the current attitude or the current approach is trying to do that. I don't think it's even trying to do that. You know, I think it's people getting petty little power fucking buzz, sitting on fucking Twitter, giving people shit. You know, I think it's pathetic.
I'm sure I'm not the first to say this to you, but if you were to consider entering politics, would you, and if you wear a T-shirt tomorrow, what would you do to change Ireland?
Oh, God.
Where would you like Ireland to go? It's quite a broad question.
Yeah. I don't think I could last in politics for two reasons. Look, I think you have to lie. So people talk about Gerry Adams and all of this, like, you know, that's a small lie, you know what I mean, that he wasn't in the IRA, you know what I mean, compared to fucking the ideological lies that people have to tell in order to get elected and things like that. So that's not in me, like, you know, not to, you know, that's my fucking problem. That's what causes me all the problem, is that I tell the truth. Now, the thing is, I'm wrong. I know I'm going to be wrong on loads of subjects, but I'm saying what I believe, you know, which you can't do, I don't think, in politics. And as well as that, then I'm fucking a disaster. I'm too scandal prone. I'd be, you know, in some big scandal before the week was out. And as well as that, if some fella turned up with fucking 200 grand in a suitcase and asked me to rezone some land, I'd be like, here, go on, fucking put up the apartments in those fields. Give me that money.
So if politics is in the future, is language the future? And if it is, how do you see yourself in it? Do you see yourself writing more books, or?
Yeah, I suppose language is and dealing with language and working with language is what I'm good at. You know what I mean? Maybe it's not necessarily what I enjoy the most, but it's what I'm most skilled at. So definitely. I'd like to maintain that yin yang. I think it's worked really well for me, of having the academic study and writing fiction. And it just balances me life out, you know what I mean? It's like they're two completely different. They're different, but there's transferable skills. They're related, you know what I mean? It's strange. I can't think of an analogy, like, you know, any other analogy in any other field. You know, I don't know, maybe like, I don't know, if someone does martial arts and does yoga or, you know, something like that, maybe, you know, it's kind of similar, you know.
One informs the other.
Yeah, but then it's also a break from the other, you know what I mean? Like, but you know, and so each time when you transfer is a break again. You know, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I don't know, it's weird.
I love as well on social media when you post stuff that you're reading, which may have been written like 500 years ago, but it's relevant to something going on in politics today. I love when you do
that. Okay, do I do it
on purpose?
You know, give me an example.
I think sometimes you put up, like, on Twitter, like, a Shakespeare quote.
Yeah.
Very suitable to what's going on right
now. I did them for a while. I did kind of a range of them. I remember when Callanan, or no, it was when Shatter resigned, Alan Shatter. He was the justice minister here. And he said, I hope I have done the state some service. Or maybe it was a Callanan who said that, the Garda commissioner. It was one of them anyway. It was the same scandal. And that's a Shakespeare quote. I've done the state some service, or he's done the state some service. And I said, I've got a better Shakespeare quote. Away with you, you coarse rascal. I'll stick a knife in your mouthy chops. You know, so Shakespeare has a quote for everything. You know what I mean? It's the same universal themes.
Which the question is it all universal themes back then? Is it now? Or was Shakespeare a genius in some way of predicting we'll be dealing with the same things?
People object to this word of genius now, but I think Shakespeare was a genius. You know, I think it's when you look at something and think, how did they do that? And I don't think, like, you know, I think that the themes and the concerns that humans had were the same kind of then, you know, politics, social status, sex, love, death, you know, it's the same stuff. But I think Shakespeare's real talent and departure from earlier writers was indeterminacy. So you can interpret the characters or the plays in so many different ways, like completely opposite. You can have completely opposite interpretations of a character, and both of them can be plausible, you know, and he doesn't nail his colours to the mast, you know what I mean? Is Hamlet good or bad? You know what I mean? This kind of stuff. You know, the villains in it, Richard III, like his most attractive character in a sense is, you know, deformed villain who kills the king and you know, kind of takes his wife and, you know, all of this sort of stuff. But Shakespeare makes you sympathise with him, you know what I mean? I think it was genius to, and the way he organises the languages on a more micro level than the way he organises languages and the quotes. Like, you know, I saw a quote today, if this were played upon a stage, I think it was an implausible fiction. And, you know, sometimes I look at my life and go, yeah, fucking, it's, you couldn't make this up. You know, it's the same kind of thing, you know, and sometimes you just catch it with a sequence of words like that are just so perfect. So I think he was a genius. Yeah. And, you know, as well, he people say, there's this kind of thing about literature now and the separation of high literature and lower literature. I think I kind of was dismissed in some ways as writing, you know, crime or something, whereas, you know, I think I write literary fiction. But Shakespeare was writing just for fucking money. You know, he was a businessman. He owned a part in the Globe Theatre. It was his theatre. And he wrote plays to put on in his theatre to get people to come in and make money. And in the Globe, they'd have Hamlet one day, and then the next day, they would have a bear with a monkey tied to its back and a load of dogs set on it and tear it to shreds. So it was whatever fucking got people in, you know what I mean? So there's and he's one of the greatest writers of our time. So the idea that you have to, you know, high art has to be the property of a few or a minority or can't be enjoyable, I think is bullshit. I think, like, The Sopranos, I think, was one of the greatest artistic creations of all time. And you know, that's watched by everybody. So I tried to do that. You know, I tried to do that in my book.
What are your plans in the future? What would you like to do?
So I've finished the PhD now, and that's behind schedule. And I'm between agents, I'm between publishers at the moment. I kind of departed with my last ones. I departed on excellent terms with my agent, with my former agent, but on less excellent. But I'm still grateful to the publisher for taking me on and allowing me to publish the book that I wanted to publish, because I've been in talks with publishers before that and they kind of wanted me to change things around and stuff like that. So I'm going to take a breather after the PhD. I have a few ideas. People want, you know, certain things. I'd like to see the Dublin 7 get the chance it deserved internationally, and things like that. But there'll be more books. I don't know if the readers will still be there, but there'll be more books.
We're looking forward to it. Thank you so much, Frankie, for coming in.
Thanks a million. It's been great. It's been great to do it with someone that I know for so long as well. It's weird, you know. You get flashbacks to working with you back in the day when we were teenagers, and it's weird ending up here sitting, you know, talking about this stuff with you.
Life is funny. It's great.
Excellent.
Our thanks again to Frankie Gaffney for the interview. His novel Dublin 7 is available now in all good bookshops. Remember to share and download Green Rebel. And if you would like to sponsor the show, send an email to greenrebelpodcast@gmail.com. Also make sure to rate and review Green Rebel. The music you heard on the show is by Laboom. Thanks for listening. Until next time.
Ba 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 ba.